Welcome, everybody. I think this is going to be a very nice occasion. We're here to debate Will Hutton's new book, and I think that's going to be very exciting. I think at this moment, Will talks in his book about the terrible weight of American conservatism and the need to show that there's a European progressive model. And I think maybe even more so since he finished the book, we're also squeezed by the weight of European conservatism and the European New Right. And so it seems to me all the more important that we discuss and debate some positive ideas which seem to have got marginalized in this current debate. So we're going to have Tony Giddens, our director, who everybody knows is going to start. And then we'll reply. Will Hutton, who probably, as you all know, has a column in The Observer, used to be the editor of The Observer, and I've known him for a very long time in left circles. So, Tony.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much, Mary, and let me also welcome everyone here this evening. And hope you have an amusing, entertaining, and certainly from Will's contributions, instructive evening. This is an important event for us, and I'm very pleased that Will and his publishers have agreed to come. And I think I've got to thank the publishers also for funding this event. Can I first of all just start by putting a few cards on the table? Will and I are good friends. We've known each other quite a long while now. We've got roughly the same political position, I would say. We're tennis partners. You know, he's got a very powerful forehand. And we even edited a book together, which was called On the Edge, Living with Global Capitalism. So you might think this debate is like what Freud called the narcissism of small differences, by which Freud meant that when you're very close to somebody, you can quite often have bigger disagreements with them than with people whose views are well away from one's own views. But I don't think this is true. I think there are some significant points of differences between myself and Will, and in what I say, in opening up this debate, I'll try to bring these out. So what I'd like to do in my contribution to this august occasion is first of all to offer a few criticisms of the book itself, but not to spend the whole time on this, because I'd like also in the end to, or in the second half, to develop some themes where I think there are differences of opinion about what we should do now, about where the UK should go, about the future of Europe, which could maybe form the main substance of the discussion which will then ensue. Will originally was going to spend 20 minutes outlining the themes of the book. Since we agreed that I would go first, if you'll forgive me, Will, I'll just spend like 3 or 4 minutes outlining the themes of the book. And Will will no doubt correct me on any misinterpretations there may be here. The book is called The World We're In. As I think every single reviewer I've seen who's discussed the book has said, it's not about the world we're in, because India, China, the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, these don't figure in the book at all. The book is essentially a comparison between the United States and Europe. And in that comparison, in Will's analysis, Europe comes off much the worst of the two. Will thinks that the US is highly inegalitarian, as indeed it is, that it's failing to live up to its democratic ideals, that it's dominated by, as it were, a new breed of conservatism, which is sweeping all before it, that it's adopting a unilateral position in world affairs, and in this, as in many other aspects that he details in the book, Europe has a great deal more to offer the world than the United States has. Will's book, it seems to me, stands in some very long existing traditions of thinking, because essentially a large part of it is about what the turn of the century, the last century, came to be called American exceptionalism. Marx and Engels were forever lamenting the fact that there were yawning inequalities in the US, far greater than in Europe, and wondering when the revolution would come in America. At the turn of the century, celebrated German author who was a very strong influence over Max Weber, who subsequently became much better known than him, but who was called Werner Zombart, wrote a famous book called Why Is There No Socialism in the United States, pointing out that the US seems to be the only industrial country which did not develop socialist traditions. Even immigrant countries where there's a great deal of space and something of a frontier spirit like the US, Zombart pointed out, like Canada or Australia, they had, however, small socialist parties. In the case of Australia, a very significant Labour Party. And Zombart's answer was, I think, pretty similar to the one that Will offers. That is, there are certain strains of affiliation to private property, to individualism, to an escape from the state, because so many immigrants to the US wanted to escape from oppression elsewhere, which have made a deep and permanent imprint on American culture and have kept it very similar from what goes on in European countries. All this is well and good, but I think the way in which Will expresses his argument, I do have a lot of reservations about. I'd just like to say briefly what these reservations are. I've got three main sets of observations that I'd like to make. I'm sure Will has heard them all before in previous discussions. First of all, what Will says about the US, while I agree with kind of the substance and the tone of a certain amount of it, seems to me quite close to being a caricature, really, of American society, of the history of the US and the place of the US in the world. Will stresses very strongly in his preface that he's not anti-American, but the book certainly reads very, very much that way. It's very hard to find a lot of good that happens in the US as you read through the book, and I'd just like to read out a quotation from the beginning where Will's talking about the US to convey the flavor of it, where Will says, "This then is contemporary America. If it is rich and entrepreneurial, it is also economically volatile, profoundly unequal, and nothing like as productive as it could be, given its enormous assets. Its democracy, one of the great Enlightenment triumphs, and a beacon of hope to many societies around the world, in the past and present, now resembles pre-Enlightenment Europe in its dependence on money and private power. This is the orderly country whose citizens routinely shoot each other. This is where worship at church is rivaled only by worship of the shopping mall. It is becoming a land of individual strangers, questing for their inner happiness because the public realm is so corrupted and depleted. It is a country that has burst its limits, an economy that is on the edge. And the whole is overshadowed by a tenacious endemic racism that is still the unresolved legacy of slavery and civil war." And he ends this paragraph saying, "This is hardly a desirable and economic social model within its own terms. To try to export it to the rest of the world," he says, "is risible." Well, I mean, that is not, you can see elements of truth in that, of course, but that is not the America which I see. It's not the US in which I lived. Probably if you add them up, something like 5 or 6 years of my life. It's not the US where you've had 200 years of unbroken democracy. It's not the US which has absorbed massive waves of immigrants, far more than any comparable society in the world has made a decent job doing so. The US seems to me far more multicultural than anything that Europe can manage at the moment. It's not the US either which has produced the most radical movements of the past 30 or 40 years. If you look at the history of feminism, free speech movements, consumer movements, ecological movements, gay rights movements, they virtually all flowered in the United States and then took root elsewhere. So the US has tremendous history, I think, of unorthodox, radical thinking, which is just not represented in the book. Moreover, the US is so diverse. To talk of the US in simple terms often doesn't make much sense. States have enormous power within the US. You can find some states in the US, for example, which if you add up local taxes, sales taxes, together with federal taxes, have a higher level of taxation than some EU countries. The US is a very, very diverse country. You can find some states like Oregon, which have a very high ecological record, better than the vast majority of EU states and so on. And Will's argument about the US tends to be that anything which looks good there turns out to be a sham on subsequent investigation, but I just don't think the arguments stand up. So if I can take an example, a field I know well, universities. Will's got a section on universities in the book in which he says, yeah, private universities, they dominate the system, you have to pay a lot of money to go there. This is a kind of betrayal of what higher education should stand for, although he does say that some of these are great universities, which surely by any reckoning they are. But if you look at American university education, it has marvelous things in it. It has the best state-based higher education system that anyone in the world has ever come up with, University of California, certainly in its heyday. Some of the best state universities are a rival for any university in the world, and certainly every bit as good as any university in the UK. You have large state universities which have had more or less an open admission system, far more democratic than anything that's ever happened here. So this picture, it seems to me, is not an accurate picture of the US, and therefore many of the comparisons which are made from it, which flow from it, are misconceived because they're based on a false starting point. Second, I would say the same of what Will calls Europe. I think also you have to put Europe in inverted commas because Europe is also very big, Europe is also very diverse. Will's message is that most of the things that happen in Europe are good, whereas most of the things that happen in the US are bad. And he has a kind of reverse caricature, in my view. If you can have a positive caricature, it's a sort of positive caricature of the best things going on in Europe, ignoring a lot of the worst things that happened there and have happened in Europe over the last 50 or so years, which is roughly the time span he tends to cover. So, I mean, in the discussion, Eastern Europe is left aside more or less altogether, doesn't even figure barely at all in the book, but Eastern Europe, after all, was in the grip of authoritarian regimes for large part of the post-Second World War period. In Europe, you had three countries which until the 1970s were military dictatorships, Spain, Portugal, and Greece. And of course, you have an earlier period of fascism in Europe, which was the source of a global conflict. So Europe has a very patchy, difficult history. It was the cockpit of two world wars. The US has successfully avoided these sorts of conflicts for whatever reason over a large part of its history. And Will, it seems to me, reverses the thing that he says in the US, where most of the good things in the US turn out to be sort of sham on subsequent scrutiny. What he tends to argue about Europe is the reverse, that most of the things that seem bad tend to be rather good if you subject them to further scrutiny. But I just don't think this holds water. For example, unemployment in Europe is discussed in, I think, 5 or 6 pages in the book, where it seems to me it's largely glossed over. Will says the job creation record of the US is not really as great as it's cracked up to be. that productivity in Europe, in some of the core European countries, excluding the UK, is as good as or catching up with the US, which is quite true. But unemployment is a core problem for Europe. Job creation is a core problem for Europe. The average proportion of people in work in Europe is only something just over 62-63%. There are 20 million people unemployed in the EU countries, and if you had an employment ratio in all of them comparable to the US, that would be something like 30 million people unemployed. It's a regional problem because it's concentrated more in the central European economies, in France, in Germany, and in Italy, and in Spain, and in Belgium. And you have some countries that do have a high employment ratio, so Europe is very diverse. But I don't think you can claim this isn't a really central issue for the EU economies, as is the stagnant nature of the German economy and a range of other problems which Europe currently faces. Thirdly, Will makes great play with the rise and dominance of conservatism in the US, but this doesn't, again, seem to me anywhere near wholly accurate. I won't go into his definition of conservatism, which is very, very wide. But his main argument is that conservatism, as he defines it in the US, is becoming all-conquering, and this is being exported to other parts of the world, including the UK, which faces this kind of specter of conservatism becoming more influential here. But I mean, again, I think it's close to being, if I might say so, and I say this because we're friends, close to being a caricature, really, of the US. Will mentions that Gore almost won in the US. Well, we know from studies that have been done of the last election that Gore would have won if Nader hadn't have stood against him. Indeed, he might have won anyway, and we all know he got a higher proportion of the popular vote than now President Bush did. This doesn't look to me to be a country in the grip of a rising tide of conservatism. It looks to me to be a divided country, where you have a liberal, cosmopolitan set of groupings, especially around the edges and in the core cities, and a conservative heartland. And I picked up this really interesting article written by an economist and research team at Carnegie Mellon University in the US, which looks at the economically successful areas of the US and shows a very high correlation between them and liberal beliefs, proportion of immigrants, homosexuals, bohemians, writers, designers, and they tend to be around the edges of the US in this kind of arrangement. And he shows close correlation between these and economic development, and this is what the US is like. There is a very large constituency of a much more liberal kind in the US, which is certainly, I think, 50-50 along with the conservative groups which Will identifies. A difficulty with the book, seems to me, is that European conservatism is not discussed at all or barely referred to. But conservative parties have dominated European history. If you look at certainly recent European history until the last 6 or 7 years, you look at Italy, for example, Christian Democrats were in power essentially as a one-party conservative state for almost the whole of the post-war period. And Will talks about the influence of business people on politics in the US, but the US doesn't have Berlusconi. Berlusconi now rules Italy, directly controls large chunks of the Italian media, has got there through means which, to say the best, are slightly dubious. So this doesn't at all look to me to be a country which is somehow a vastly superior model to the United States. You'd have to say that certain aspects of certain European countries at certain times will point us the way, and I'd be much happier with a more qualified version of that. These limitations in the book mean to me that the discussion of the future of Britain, the role of Britain in Europe, the future of the European Union, is also limited or wanting because it starts from false premises. And let me just, in closing, mention four areas for discussion where I think my views would be at least somewhat different from Will's, although no doubt different from many other people in the audience too. Will says he believes in the European social model. Well, I believe in the European social model. But the question is, what kind of European social model? What is the future of the European social model? I think we need a reformed European social model, because the conditions under which the old social model of the 60s and 70s flourished no longer exist. We know there have been so many changes. We must address the issue of job creation in Europe as part of a changed European social model. Will is very critical of the Lisbon summit of 3 years ago, which wanted to make Europe competitive with the US, but I would have a much more favorable view of the European summit, of the Lisbon summit myself, because a lot of its prescriptions, it seemed to me, are necessary if Europe is seriously to rival and outstrip the US economically and in other areas. We do have, I think, quite a strong difference of opinion on labor markets, because I think the best European social model is one where you have reasonably liberal labor markets, because you've got to get people into jobs and you've got to help create jobs, but where you have active social protection to allow people to cope effectively with technological change and indeed to embrace it. So if you look at the countries with the best economic records in Europe, like Denmark or Holland, that's what they've done. They've got active labour market policies of the kind introduced here in the UK later on, introduced in Denmark in the early 1990s, introduced here in 1997, 1998. That way you can have a country with a high proportion of people in work who are well protected, but where you don't have dysfunctional aspects of rigid labour markets, which mean you have essentially dualistic insider-outsider labour markets. I can't myself see how Germany can change and generate more jobs if it doesn't make some such innovations. You must make it possible for small businesses to flourish. Well, European regulation, you look at Italy, you look at Germany, very, very difficult for small business to flourish. So a whole package of things seem to me to be necessary to revive and to have a resurgent European social model. Second, Will raises the issue of Britain becoming more European. I'm heavily in favor of this. I think Britain needs to be more cosmopolitan, closer to Europe, more in touch with diversity of cultures in Europe. Don't have any problem with that. Yet, I think you have to recognize the UK is and will continue to be different from the core continental countries. That is because, as Timothy Garton-Ash said in his debate with you, Will, that the UK will remain part of a wider English-speaking Commonwealth, not just the United States, but the whole range of Commonwealth countries. These are countries which have had stable democratic systems over many, many years, and it seems entirely reasonable for Britain to be part of this wider community as well as linked to Europe. I don't see these things are inconsistent, and I would see them as going together. People tend to scorn Tony Blair's ideas that UK should be a bridge between Europe and the US, but I think this is actually a very feasible role for the UK, and it's quite consistent with it being more of a European country than it is at the moment. Thirdly, Will tends to pour scorn on the New Labour project and say it's not substantial enough and so forth, but I just disagree with him on this. I think what New Labour is trying to do is essentially participate in creating a new social model for this country. And I think the economic record of New Labour in power is vastly superior to any previous Labour government that you would care to indicate when Labour governments have been in power before. Although you can make many criticisms of it, New Labour has succeeded in doing the things that a modern social democratic party must do: have effective reforms, but also remember that you must win elections and keep in power in order to sustain reforms, something which arguably very recently other social democratic parties in Europe have forgotten. I heard Gordon Brown a couple of weeks ago tell a very good story about this, which came from George Bernard Shaw, as you remember, one of the founders of the LSE, which George Bernard Shaw was talking about the fate of one of his plays, which did very badly. And he said the play was excellent, but the audience was terrible. Well, you know, a left of center party today must be in touch with what people in the country want, and it must make sure it has a program that allows it to correspond to the needs that people have. Can't just be driven by some ideology which might be quite ideologically pure, but out of touch with what is needed to get a party into power and allow it to make real changes. Fourthly and finally, I think in this session we must discuss issues that don't really figure again much in the book at all, but which are plainly at the forefront of the changes now happening in Europe. Europe, as we know, has been much explored in the newspapers recently, now dominated by the right rather than by the left. It's the traditional situation in Europe, as I said earlier, and the issues which this raises, immigration, multiculturalism, job creation, criminality, these are issues which left of centre parties must take seriously and must work out rational and effective, equitable strategies to. Will doesn't discuss these in the book, but I know he has opinions on these, and in some respects anyway, on these issues, I believe our opinions might tend to converge. Finally, in conclusion, I think it is right to say there's an interesting shift going on in the world, and that's related to the big theme of Will's book, the insufficiencies of shareholder value as a means of driving a modern capitalist economy. Another thing which I feel we must debate. But in the wake of the incredible scandals affecting the US at the moment, in core parts of its economic institutions, the corruption you find there is only rivaled by the corruption you find in European capitalism, which is of a different kind. But if you look at what happened when the French railway system were building the TGVs, and you look at the extraordinary corruption that was involved there, I don't think you could say the US or Europe is in the lead on these things, but certainly there's probably some shift ideologically going on, which might be a shift that both Will and I would endorse. When you get The Economist having two issues, one which says the death of the corporate hero, another which says the wickedness of Wall Street, then I think you can be sure there is some ethos which is shifting here, and I, like Will, hope that it will shift towards a more responsible form of capitalistic activity. But I feel that responsible form of capitalistic activity must be organized in the context of a much more malleable, a much more shifting version of what center-left parties stand for than was true 20 or 30 years ago. Thank you.
Well, I'll go straight to Will to answer those strong criticisms.
Not strong.
Well,
start.
Well, thanks. It was. I think the next book I write, I'm going to put the really juicy paragraphs, not in chapter one, but in chapters 8, 9, and 10, and see whether the reviewers get that far.
We get far enough if it's near the end. We just read the beginning and the end.
I remember writing that, thinking to myself, you know, well, this bit needs a bit of a kind of, you know, give the section a bit of a swing, because the poor reader has now been kind of, we're kind of 7,000 or 8,000 words into chapter one. So, you know, it's quite interesting how that particular bit has been outtaken by the Wall Street Journal and now Tony, and of course The Economist, the same Economist criticizing me for my indictment of American shareholder value-driven capitalism as not knowing what I was talking about before doing its two issues that Tony's just described. Where to begin? I think the place to start probably is over the rise of American conservatism, which I do think is the most salient political fact of the last 25, 30 years. I do think it's substantially different in character from American conservatism, from European conservatism. I think it's driven the entire economic, political, social, and cultural geography of the states to the right to a degree that we in Europe don't really understand. I don't think that European governments have understood, for example, how what drives American unilateralism. I don't think they understand the position of people like Wolfowitz and John Ashcroft. John Ashcroft is seen as rather the Attorney General, is seen as a comic figure. in American terms, he is his fervent patriotism is part of a conservative ideological framework, which makes perfect sense in American terms. minimalist over the state, highly patriotic, taking the view that religion is actually the cement that holds the states together. He borrows his ideas from the great American right-wing political philosopher Leo Strauss. A lot of people in the Bush administration are Straussians. Wolfowitz is a Straussian. And it's difficult to... why is it that the Republican Party, the parts of the Republican Party, have actually bought into this philosophy? And what's been going on? And here in the book, I try to identify a whole bunch of things that have been happening in the States. The movement of economic and social gravity away from those seaboards that Tony showed in his little map. The South and the West, the old Confederacy, have become much more important in American terms than they used to be. There's that. There is the blue-collar backlash, which Reagan exploited so successfully in the late 70s and early 80s, against the liberal agenda of affirmative action and busing and all the rest of it. And it must be said, and it's an uncomfortable thing to say, because I'm no friend of European racism, but the American language that the right developed over welfare dependency was well understood in American political terms as being black urban city dwellers dependent upon white middle class taxpayers. And that was well understood as part of the subtext of the rise of the American right. And it's one of the reasons why capital punishment is so gets the degree of support it does in the States, is because the vast proportion of people who suffer capital punishment aren't white. And it doesn't mean that I don't condemn Le Pen and all the rest of it, but I think that some of the reaction to my book, in that Europe is disfigured, and Tony didn't quite get there, but nearly did, that actually I neglect European fascism and European racism, which I don't do. I was very impressed by Mark Mazzauer's book, The Dark Continent, which I quote. And there's a number of passages in the book where I'm very concerned about that temptation in Europe. But I think not to understand the role it plays in American politics is make an enormous mistake. Another element in the rise of the American right has been the impact of money on American politics. 98% of incumbents in the States win. They get re-elected. And the reason they get re-elected is because they have their nose in front in the fundraising stakes. So that what's happened since the mid-70s is that with the rise of profitability in corporate America and the rise in inequality in America, is that the paymasters of the American political process have been essentially corporations and rich individuals. The contributions from the rich tend to disproportionately be from Republicans and from Democrats, and that's helped to drive the whole discourse to the right. And that discourse is the Washington Consensus, as it's portrayed internationally and domestically. It's about government minimalism, but minimal taxation, minimal regulation. It's very against notions of a social contract, because it gets in the way of individual liberty and obliges the state to be coercive in the sense of constraining individuals in their choices. Now, I maintain that the way that the political debate has gone in Britain would have been very difficult to have had the same trajectory if it hadn't been for that taking place in the States. And I maintain that within the States, it hasn't had particularly good economic and social outcomes. I don't want to talk for too long, because I really want Tony to come back and then to get you engaged in this argument. But just to take one example, the example that Tony picked out, which was the thing about universities. I really repeatedly in the book argue that yes, American university sector, particularly the top 50 universities in the States, are not just equal to the best in Europe, but are substantially better. They are very rich institutions. They pay extraordinarily well. And Tony, as director of the LSE, knows how difficult it is to attract internationally renowned faculty paying British pay rates compared with the ones that are available in the States. They have become the centres of the ICT revolution. It's very difficult to understand American dominance in ICT without looking at the linkages, complex linkages, between this rich and intellectually adventurous university system, the technological transmission mechanisms that exist there, and the growth of not just small businesses, but actually big ICT companies around it. I call it ideopolises in the book, and there's a number of, and I think the ideopolis, or the technopolis as they sometimes are called, are really interesting notions, and ones that we in Europe, and one of these arguments I use, the European Union should do much more to copy this. But that said, the notion that American universities are institutions as they were, and Tony's right, the great land-granted funded state universities at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, great institutions, but the notion that the university system is an avenue of income and social mobility in the States is actually not as true now as it was even 25 years ago. I was really impressed by the numbers on social mobility in the States at two levels, both at the top and at the bottom. At the top, just 20 years ago, you were only four times more likely, if you were born into a family in the top quartile of the income distribution, to go to college than one born in the bottom quartile. Now, the latest numbers I could find, which were the mid-1990s, showed that ratio deterioration from 4 to 1 to 10 to 1. And the reason for that is that these universities have become very expensive. The growth of the... it's been very difficult for any universities outside the top 5 or 6 to maintain the growth of their endowment income so that they can actually have needs-blind admission in the way that Tony described. It was certainly true when he was over there 15, 20, 25 years ago. But now there are only a handful of universities that are doing it, and those who know in the American debate well, it's a really one of the really live issues in the States. The grants to help low-income students in America, the Pell Grant, has actually fallen from around 70-80% of what it cost to go to university in the mid-1970s to under 35% today, because Republican and Democrat administrations in federally and actually at state level have cut that back, and they've replaced it with income tax credits for the middle class. The Hope Scholarship was one of Clinton's reforms, because you couldn't get spending increases through, but you get tax cuts through, if tax cuts were favored for something good, which was university education. So as an avenue of social mobility, American universities are not what they were. And this is well understood in the States, or beginning to be understood in the States, by Democrats and by liberals, people who share the same views as me and Tony. At the bottom of the income distribution, the exit rates from poverty in the States are actually worse than the principal European countries and the Nordic countries. And that's because the public education system below university level is very poor, is very poor indeed. It's a massive concern to American citizens, and it should surface more in American democratic discourse. And the reason it doesn't is because, as I said, the American democratic discourse is not functioning as well as it used to in representing ordinary people's concerns because of the role of money in American politics, and actually the fact that so many people who could and should vote don't vote. And one reason they don't vote is the disillusion by the system. They don't engage with it, and consequently you get in this kind of self-fulfilling downward vortex. Now that's just to say that. On this question of unemployment and whether I have a rosy picture of Europe and a kind of, and everything in America that's good looks a sham, I really do reject that, Tony. I think that I try to argue in the passage of the book, chapter 4 of the book, that actually one of the reasons for the, when I trace the history of Boeing, that actually if you want to really understand America's ICT dominance and its technological dominance, there's a complicated relationship between government and the banking system. I mean, the American banking system, regulated after the New Deal, does a very effective job of actually supporting small and medium-sized enterprise in the States, and in many respects looks very German in its character. But actually, one of the things that happened in the Clinton years was the abolition of Glass-Steagall and the rules on constraining the growth of interstate banking, and have actually led to an enormous consolidation in the American banking system and a turning away from and their traditional role of actually supporting grassroots American enterprise. That isn't a sham. I actually describe it as I believe it is. Nor do I, to reverse the situation, regard European unemployment as, in some sense, not disfiguring. There's more than five or six pages. There's a passage in chapter four on it, and there's various reflections on it throughout the book. There's a passage in chapter seven when I write about Britain on it. My argument about European unemployment is that exactly the same as yours, actually. I actually argue that one of the reasons why German unemployment remains so high is that there aren't incentives in the German system of social insurance for job search, and that the combination of having a kind of New Deal-type settlement in Germany plus running their economy at higher levels of demand would very quickly lower unemployment in Germany. And I don't believe that those labour market reforms would actually amount to the dismantling of the European social model as it's represented in Germany. There is no disagreement because I actually write that I agree with this position. I want to say something about enterprise in the context of your closing remarks. I compare a number of European enterprises with their American counterparts in the book. And the reason I did this is because I really want to challenge the notion that a successful capitalist enterprise is only about the prosecution of shareholder value. I believe that successful organizations, business organizations, are just that, successful business organizations. And I borrow from the work of two American business school professors at Stanford, Corris and Pollins, they wrote a wonderful book called Built to Last, where they describe great visionary companies, and actually what they characterize as what these visionary companies in America have in common, having an organizational purpose that they put at their core rather than the prosecution of shareholder value, and all the things that flow from it, the social glue that holds an organization together and all the rest, being able to move flexibly and fast, has actually, in my view, been pulled down over the last 15 or 20 years by this doctrine of that the only purpose of a capitalist organization is to maximize shareholder value. Now, you can't separate that from the rise of conservatism in the States. That's the first point to make. And the second point to make is that the much-derided Europeans have actually kept the systems of corporate governance and all the rest in place, which allow their corporations to have this notion at their core. One of the reasons I think Airbus is beating Boeing is precisely this reason. The subsidy for Airbus is actually lower than that now going to Boeing. I think it's the reason behind Nokia's success against Motorola, Volkswagen's success against Ford, and Michelin's success against Goodyear. And I could have chosen another half dozen companies where the same was true. And I think that the kind of cluster of values which I believe underpin a kind of European conception, ideas about the social contract, ideas about fairness in the way you run your capitalist system, and the primacy of the public realm in actually organizing fairness and the social contract, spill over into the culture that informs the way Europeans run their organizations. Hence the reason, and again, not actually what's commonly accepted as the common sense, the reason why the productivity gap has been so successfully closed in mainland Europe, when we have a yawning gap still. I don't think we've actually got this right at all, but on this you and I are in agreement. I just think we need to look to Europe for our models, and that one reason I'm critical of the Lisbon summit is because it was overtly looking to America rather than actually seeing in its own backyard what worked well. A couple of points and I'll stop. You made the point about the not talking much about the European right. The point I want to make is that the left-right argument in Europe starts off around a position that is many degrees already to the left than that in the States. Thus, German Christian Democrats and even Chirac's right-wing party that's taken power in France have a much closer commitment to notions of the social contract, notions of the public realm, and notions of fair capitalism than actually their counterparts have in the States. So that the whole discourse is substantively to the left. I mean, a number of German friends who've read my book say that actually the people who will really like my book in Germany are going to be German Christian Democrats. And we know that people who are going to hate my book are going to be the American right. And that, I think, characterizes two different discourses which reflect actually where the centers of gravity are in respective civilizations. But I want to finish off by making some remarks about globalization. You and I both spent a lot of time talking about this and arguing about it and writing about it. And you and I both agree that one dimension of globalization is the unleashing of an enormous amount of private corporate power. And if we want to, if we need global public goods, then we need institutions of multilateral global governance. And this argument is not just about whether the European economic and social model has got a lot of things going for it that actually the discourse in Britain doesn't acknowledge, and that the American economic and social model has profound problems, which I think are now only just heaving into view. If only I had, if I'd written anything as severe as Hank Paulson, chief executive and chairman of Goldman Sachs, about American capitalism in my book, I mean, the bile that got poured over my head by the Economist would have been turned into red-hot lava. I was mild in comparison with Hank Paulson, who says there's the biggest crisis of confidence in American capitalism in his working career. And we're not talking about a kind of a member of the liberal left commentariat, Will Hutton, here. We're talking about, you know, one of the head honchos of Wall Street, Hank Paulson. But Hank Paulson can say it, and everyone's very sage, and the IMF can write commentary saying Enronitis is really undermining the confidence in American financial markets. But if Will Hutton writes it, there's a kind of rush to describe me as anti-American, and so I'm not understanding the complexities of America, which is such a diverse, can't make such sweeping statements. They're made by Americans of America, and Europeans in Europe can make them too, especially as, in an era of globalization, what happens in the predominantly powerful power of them all so intimately impacts on all of us. And here's my end remarks. The European Union, for all its weaknesses, and I'm very aggressive about what those weaknesses are in the book, to the degree to which some people in the European Commission regard me as a card-carrying Eurosceptic. But for all its weaknesses, the European Union is probably the most successful multilateral institution we've got going in the world at the moment. It does succeed in actually framing common systems of governance and principles for a continent which is, as you've acknowledged, very diverse. And the way it's chosen to do it, and the mechanisms and procedures it's going about doing it, and the ways it's thinking about improving its accountability are a model, imperfect that they are, and they need deepening, a model or an exemplar of what could be done globally. And actually, that is actually the big choice. The big choice at the moment is whether we're to accept a world which is actually essentially run around the principles of American conservatism by a country which has taken putting America first to kind of ideological standing, which is throwing its weight around in the way that everyone in the room knows, all the international treaties that have been unilaterally abrogated in the last 18 months are extraordinary, a litany of disengagement. Or we can say that those aren't the principles, the multilateralist principles are the ones, and that they are best represented, as far as we know in Europe, by the European Union, which is the only effective countervailing force to the United States conceivable in the world. There are passages in my book, by the way, about China. And there are only references I acknowledge. I borrow Robert Wade's figures about the growth of global inequality to kick off chapter 5. And I'm, in a sense, I'm, in one way, I'm apologetic about it because it's made me a subject of a kind of easy hit, because the book isn't all-encompassing as the title might suggest. But my excuse for this is this, is that actually, for the Brazilians, for the South Africans, indeed for the Indians and the Japanese, unless the relationship between the US and the EU works, which represents, you know, close on a half of world GDP, you can't get those multilateral systems of governance to be operational. That is actually a global reality. And that's why I focused on them in the way that I do. And it isn't actually because I don't believe that those other countries have not got a significant, you know, staking what those outputs are or should have. It's just the realpolitik of the contemporary world as I see it. Thank you very much, everybody.
going to give it back to Tony to let him have one more go before we open it up to questions, but I want to ask them both questions. So my question to Will is, listening to you, isn't your definition of left and right around the issue of welfare and distribution? I think the European right, take Bismarck for example, has often been in favour of welfare. But the problem with the European right is that it's authoritarian and racist. And I, for one, would be rather nervous if my book was liked by the current German Christian Democrats. And that's my question to Will. I mean, isn't there another... Don't you have to also take into account issues of freedom, liberty, civil liberties, and those issues when defining left and right? And that's where... Tony's points about the range of civil liberties movements that have influenced the whole world in America is so important. And my question to Tony is, I mean, you're saying governments have to win elections, so they have to take into account what the electorate want. Aren't there limits to that? I mean, at the moment, the present government's language on asylum seekers makes me, for one, extremely nervous, and it may well be that that is pandering to certain prejudices in the electorate. Don't governments and parties have a responsibility to influence what the electorate thinks and not just respond? So I'll give Tony first and then Will.
This is the thing. I noticed some people sidling off. We were thinking we'd go on to 8 o'clock and have a sort of decent amount of audience participation, but there's no obligation on everyone or indeed anyone to stay to that time.
I can argue until midnight, actually.
I would like to respond just briefly to what Will says. Main reason being, not the nature of what he said, but the way in which he said it, because this is what we're here for. You're supposed to buy this book. If you buy this book, you will discover a different Will in this book from the Will who just spoke to you. Because this is calm, reasoned, qualified Will, and this is strident, I think, sometimes caricatured argument Will. And I thought, I mean, to my view, there's a big difference between what he just said now and what he says in the book. And the only way for you to decide is actually to check the book. Let me just comment briefly on three issues which I think would like to discuss with a wider audience as well. I think it's wrong to identify the US with American conservatism, as Will tends to do. I'd remind you that Gore effectively won the election. Gore stands for, in the American sense, a liberal point of view. The US has a vast array of cities in which you have extremely cosmopolitan populations with a whole diversity of what in European terms are European liberalism, very liberal views. So I'd repeat, the US is split down the middle rather than a country which is being conquered by conservatism. Second, the blue-collar backlash is not limited to the US. It's very, very visible in European countries too. And it's one of the main causes for the rise of the far right in Europe, where we know from studies that have been done over the last 3 or 4 years, because far right started developing over the last 10 years or something in European countries, that a large source of support for far right is disaffected blue-collar, especially male groups, very similar to the same groups who you find supporting certain variants of conservatism in the US. So one can't pretend that is just a US issue. It's a European one, or a more generic one, industrial countries, because, you know, you look at Pauline Hanson in Australia, her views are pretty similar to views of far-right leaders in Europe. So this is not a Europe versus US thing. It's much more of a generic thing in industrial countries under current conditions. Finally, I must say a bit about universities, because I just really disagree with Will on this, because you look at the proportion of children from poorer backgrounds getting into British universities, it's really tiny. So it's just not the case that the UK, or indeed Europe, with its primarily, almost wholly state-based universities, is doing better for poorer groups. God, it's not. Only 1% of kids from unskilled backgrounds get into university in this country, and that proportion has been going down rather than going up as universities expand. So in lots of these things, you're dealing with generic issues which most industrial countries face, where there's a different record between some European countries and some parts of the US, It is, I think, a much more complex picture, at least, than is presented in this book. And if you don't recognize its complexities, you're not going to be able to develop the right kinds of policies to confront these issues, which are structural issues more than they're Europe versus US issues. If I can answer Mary's question, political parties must lead public opinion. And arguably, the main reason why you have capital punishment in the US that Will laments, and I would also lament, is that in some sense, a more democratic country, that is, it represents what people really feel. We know that in the majority of European countries, the majority of the population are in favor of capital punishment, certainly for certain classes of crimes, but I believe governments are quite right to stand out against that kind of pressure, and certainly that would also apply to pressures surrounding at least some aspects of immigration and other issues. So you certainly don't want a government which just panders to the worst aspects of the beliefs of certain categories of the population, but you do want a government that recognizes, for example, that people have real worries about crime, and that you must offer policies which help address those worries. And those are issues which I think, on the whole, New Labour in this country has been more effective in dealing with, even though I wouldn't support all of the ways in which they tried to do so, than, for example, the French Socialists or the plural coalition in France was. And look at the difference now between the two countries.
It's rich stuff, isn't it? I think I've written 141,000 words, and not enough, really, words. And I thought when I got to the end of it, 141,000 words was quite enough for most readers.
This is true.
I don't know how you did it.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, there's so many issues that you want to cut a level deeper in. But I want to open up because, if just to answer to Mary's point, I do identify the social contract and the politics of redistribution around universalist principles as a kind of core component of what I call a kind of commonly held European value system. So yeah, I mean, I you're right to pick me up on that, and that's right. Two other things I'd add to it, though, which is that I go into some detail about. One is a kind of much more a stakeholder view about property, actually, or about the necessity to run capitalism fairly. I don't want to do too much of that except to say I do think conceptions about property in the States and in Europe are very differently held, as you'd expect from a largely country where great amounts of property were free to settlers, and where in Europe they've already the notion of rights and obligations around property is inevitable, given the much more kind of long-standing settleness nature of it, and the relationship of it to Catholicism, feudalism, socialism, have meant that anyone who holds private property and our attitudes of private property in Europe are ones in which we really do believe that that private property holders have obligations to the community which they're parts. That's another component of it. And a third element is this belief in the public realm, a kind of an enlightenment notion of the public realm. But I think that Europe and Western and American civilization hold a number of things in common, actually. And one of them is a deep commitment to, UN Declaration on Human Rights. There's a small industry in holding, Americans to account for their shortcomings in it, and Europeans in their shortcomings for it. But actually, I do say this in the book. I mean, it's not in one sense what holds these civilizations hold in common around the price mechanism, or commitment to the rule of law, or a commitment to alternance of government through democracy, regarding human rights as inalienable, is actually what they hold in common. And when the barriers go up, it's why one's shoulder to shoulder with Americans. That doesn't mean, however, that the other points I've tried to make don't exist and aren't challenging and don't require a response.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to open it up now.
There should be roving mics going around the room.
Yeah, and do if give your name and say who you are, because that makes it interesting.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. I like knowing who's asking the question. Okay, I'm looking
around.
Should we
take several?
Yeah, let's take several. I can see one. I can only see hands up here. I can see two up here, and there are a few down here. Okay, first person up there.
Good evening. My name is Barrett Bradstreet. My question is for Mr. Hutton. I have two observations, and I wonder if you might, if these observations of mine might temper your opinion of social mobility in the U.S. The first regards university education, and unfortunately, I don't have a comprehensive set of statistics, but I do know that at the university from which I come, 85% of the students receive one sort of financial aid or another. And I do know that that percentage is a tremendous increase on the percentage from, say, 20 to 30 years ago. That's the first observation. Secondly, I know in one excerpt from your book, I've heard a comment that Abraham Lincoln's drive from a log cabin to the White House would not be possible in today's America. And yet I've noticed, for example, that the President Bill Clinton, in fact, came from incredibly impoverished background in rural Alabama, rural Arkansas. And managed to make it to the White House. And so my question is, do these two observations temper your view of social mobility in the U.S.?
Okay, and I'm gonna, that person over there.
Okay, I want to address myself to something that Professor Giddings said. You tended to downplay the differences between America and Europe. Your point was, as I understand it, your basic contention that, you know, America is diverse and Europe is diverse, and America is full of right-wing reactionaries and so is Europe, and America's horrible problems of racism and inequality and poverty, and so does Europe. So, but it occurs to me that there is a fundamental difference between America and Europe, and it has to do with the relationship between the citizen and the assets of their respective societies. European countries, I'm thinking of preeminently of Britain before the abolition of exchange controls in 1980 or wherever it was. Britain was a commonwealth in the sense that there was something called British capital, which was a legally or administratively defined concept, and all adult men and women in Britain had a defined relationship to that capital resource. They were all equal shareholders in the Commonwealth.
Can you make it short?
Right. This is telling a bit of a lecture. What I was saying, it was possible in Britain for people to control wealth, great wealth. The point is they controlled that wealth, they didn't own it. It was possible for the people at large to take a legitimate interest in what they did with that wealth. In America, by contrast, you have an individualistic confederal system of property ownership where individuals have absolute rights of ownership over the wealth they control. And the public has no right, essentially, to influence their decisions with respect to that wealth.
Okay, thank you.
I'm
going to take
that
two
at all
more
clear?
Downstairs, and I'm going to ask you very kindly to be brief. I was being generous to start with, but if you could be. I'll take the lady down here and the gentleman there.
My name's Sean Kelly. I was a student here in 1988 to 91 when the Students' Union elected Winston Silcott chairman. I have nothing to do with that, but I was interviewed outside because the TV cameras couldn't find any American students who wanted to be interviewed because they were too afraid, because they were all getting funded back home. They were terrified to say what they taught because their funding might be pulled. And I found the US students that I mixed with here 10 years ago were very conservative. And I do think Mr. Hutton's observation that US conservatism is a huge factor is probably quite correct. I'd like to ask, I mean, since September the 11th, things have changed, and I was very glad Tony Blair was there to kind of calm down W, who most people of any intelligence have absolutely no respect for. Aren't you glad that Tony Blair is there to kind of hold back the forces of the right in the US. And can Blair hold, can he make a difference, or is it going to be the other way around? Because actually we all know how much the education system in this country has become more like in the US, as in the abolition of student grants, which I was one of the last people to benefit from. So what I'm saying is that social mobility is worse in this country than it was 30 years ago. And that's directly in my view, because we've been influenced by the US. And this country is far from being more influenced. Ireland, where I come from, is more European than Britain is. And to me, that's a problem. But having said that, I'm quite glad Blair is there to keep W underhands. That wasn't a question, I'm sorry.
You have that gentleman over there. Being very hard to get people to do questions rather than little speeches, but the speeches are very interesting.
In a debate, people can make statements, in my opinion, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Peter Lacey from the European Academy of Business and Society. Both Professor Giddens and Will Hutton touched on the idea of shareholder value and also the increasing...
If he's going to be Will Hutton, I'm going to be Tony Giddens because that's more egalitarian.
Sorry. Tony Giddens and Will Hutton.
Tony Giddens and Professor Hutton.
Seems to be, perhaps. You both touched on the idea of shareholder value and the changing notion of shareholder value and the pressure to reform that as an important engine for change socially. And you also talked of the social responsibility of business, which is increasingly growing. I would suggest probably more so in Europe than perhaps in the US. Now, this has probably been born from a variety of factors, but certainly one of the things that has driven that is a changing balance between the public and the private and the increasing power of corporations. What do you see as being a solution to that? We now have a situation where there's, to some extent, a global governance vacuum. And what can a European model do to try and fill that void?
Okay. Shall we take one more up there before we go to the...
Good comment.
My name's Rachel Ullman, I work at the LSE. I will be brief. My question was to pick up on Mary's point specifically about immigration and ask Tony whether he thinks that the government should be doing more to lead on this issue, as it seems very much to be pandering to a minority of people who are hardline anti-immigration, anti-asylum seekers, rather than it seems this is an area which is ripe to be led from the front, to lead probably the majority of people who are not anti-asylum seekers, don't really know much about the issue, and aren't racist.
Okay, I'm going to allow David Held one quick word.
Oh, come on, give us a break.
This is a question, not a statement, and there are two very short bits to it. The first one is to Tony Giddens. Why is the Washington
consensus... Can you speak up?
Yes, the first question is to Tony Giddens.
Speak up.
The first question is to you, Tony. Why is the Washington consensus called the Washington consensus? And what do you think the theoretical and political significance of that is? Doesn't Will have an underlying point that the driving force behind this deregulatory market ideology has come first and foremost from the States? Secondly, to Will, if there was a Brussels consensus, what would it be?
Whoa! We should have allowed him here a microphone, shouldn't we?
Okay. Let's start with Will.
Right. Well, to the American friend from above, I think she's still there. Ah, you are. Look, one of the I've worried a lot about the judgment calls I made when writing the book about the rhetoric and all the rest of it, because I really am, and you'll find this odd, but I actually. The passage that Tony read out, where I talked about American democracy, the hope, one of the great kind of triumphs of the Enlightenment ideas, and the American Constitution. I mean, I buy all that. Despite what I've written, because of what I've written, it's actually I love the country. And you know, and it's this mismatch between American rhetoric and reality that actually continually gets me. Now, it is true that Clinton came from modest backgrounds, but you know, and the, I'm sure there's people here who've got 95-year-old grandmothers who smoke 25 cigarettes a day, and that doesn't mean that actually smoking cigarettes isn't dangerous for your health. You have to look at things, you know, systemically and structurally. And I maintain, along with, again, I mean, the people I cite in my defense, I mean, it's quite interesting, as a, here I am, a kind of British liberal writing about America, and one of the best bits of evidence I could find for my case came from, not from American social scientists, but from a group called the Campaign for Responsible Taxation, run by 120 billionaires, led by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates Sr. And they're the people who in 98 formed this campaign to not accept President Clinton's capital gains tax reductions on the grounds that they were already rich enough. And actually they knew through their own personal networks, as Warren Buffett famously said, that actually the kind of arteries of America were actually shutting down. He said, we have a system already in education that is structured around the rich having, you know, the dice loaded enormously in their favor. It's as if, he said, we Americans are choosing the American Olympic team in 2020 from the sons and daughters of those who won medals in the Olympics in 2000. That's the system we've got. Now, this is an Englishman repeating an American back to you. And I do think that, I mean, the absolute levels of sociability in the States are still good, but they're falling. And in important respects, they are equaled and sometimes challenged by the numbers in Europe. And we are, but overall, the trend in all our societies, and I think someone picked this up, I mean, sociability is also falling in the UK. And, you know, we need to recognize what's taking place and look it in the eye. Would there be a Brussels model? Well, I've got to try and have an answer to that question by the end of August, when I'm going to talk to the European Commission about this. The straight answer is that there's not a Brussels model. The Commission is ruptured by big differences over what the way forward is. The majority of European commissioners are in favor of, in a sense, the kind of Lisbon process as set out in, as Tony has set it out, which in my book is, it's not really, but it's close enough to it to make the rhetorical point. It's close to the Americanization of Europe, really. We want American-type labor markets, American-type financial institutions, American-type venture capital, all that. And there's a minority of commissioners who actually really do believe there's a European economic and social model, but they're in the minority. And the Commission's kind of is paralyzed because they're sufficiently strong, and certainly their supporters in individual countries are strong enough to kind of obstruct the Lisbon process. So there's terrible stasis in Europe that's taking place at the moment, which is frustrating for everybody. And I suppose one of my hopeful outcomes in the book is to kind of strengthen the hand of those who think there should be a Brussels consensus, and to weaken the hand of those who think that, you know, we can simply import the American model into Europe, which I don't think we can. There's lots of other points, but I'll pass the microphone to Tony.
Well, I'd like to respond to all the points, if I could, very briefly. I don't know if this might be still...
I just worry about the time, that's all.
Yeah, well, me too, but... Because I thought that they were all good points. I mean, I think the first point about universities... was an important one. That is, in the US, it is true that US universities give far more financial assistance than UK ones do.
But they need to, because they're so much more expensive.
But this means that...
It's a fundamental point. I mean,
But I mean, you're wrong about it, because...
I'm not wrong about it.
Yes, you are. I know about universities. If you're a graduate student here, for example, the amount of support that you can get from the state compared to the amount of support you can get if you apply to American university is completely out of line in favor of the US university. It's one of the main problems we face in the LSE at the moment, is the high level of financial support that is given to students in universities. And this is true of middle level as well as higher level universities. There is another interesting twist on it, which I think Will would appreciate, which is, as in so many things in the US, there's a kind of hidden state involvement, which goes against the rhetoric of the kind of minimal state. A high proportion of colleges in the US are actually supported by the state, but they're not supported by subventions directly as we have here, and they're supported much more by competitive research grants. So some of the so-called private universities get over 50% of their support from the state. Well, the LSE gets a lot less support from the state than that. So it shows you again the complexities of some of these comparisons. And it was suggested that I tended to downplay the differences between the US and Europe, but I don't. I just question Will's portrayal of those differences. Those differences are real. There's a famous experiment that was done where a group of American students and British students, business people, were asked if they owed anything to the welfare state. This was carried out, I think, about 10 years ago, but almost all the British raised their hands and not a single American raised his or her hand, showing that attitudes towards the welfare system are different, and it's different when you have a more substantial welfare state. It does help you reduce inequalities. It does create more of a public domain. It is something that one should support, and I'm wholly in accord with that, but I don't think you can base an argument on caricaturing both sides of the fence in this way. Moreover, one has to remember that this is a heavily elitist society, the UK, and that's only changed quite recently, all these crusty, awful institutions, these awful forms of privilege and so on that went alongside the welfare system, and many of these didn't exist in the same way in the US, which on the level of everyday life, in my experience, has been much more democratic than the UK or most European countries have been. Thirdly, yes, I hope Tony Blair can play some kind of role in holding back what the current US administration will do. But I would stress again, the current US administration is not America. Gore probably won the election anyway. And if he'd won, I think, obviously you could always say, well, look, he's more conservative than Social Democrat would be in European countries. This is probably true. But I think it might have actually influenced what happened in Europe. I don't think you've probably got the same turn to the right in Europe if you'd had a continuation of a democratic presidency in the US, because when Clinton first got into power, it was one of the levers that helped promote an expansion of return to power of Social Democrats in the UK. So a lot of things in politics happen through contingencies. Clinton would never have got into power if Ross Perot had not stood and divided the right vote. The opposite happened this time. The same in Italy. You know, the left got its act together 6 years ago and it won. This time it was divided and the right got its act together, and the same thing happened in France. So there is not a tide of conservatism sweeping, I think, either through the US or Europe. There is a much more open play of electoral forces. Fourth question was about shareholder value. I mean, I'm in favor of both a mixture of incentives and sanctions, which ensure that corporations live up to their social responsibilities. I think the milieu of corporations has changed across the world, because in a global society with global communications, nothing a corporation does can be hidden from public view. The bigger a corporation is, the more it depends on its brand image. Brand image can now be attacked successfully, especially by the rise of NGO groups across the world. First major example of that was the Brent Spa episode. Shell Oil Company to this day has not recovered from that encounter. So there is something going on there which I think will promote increased corporate responsibility, and that's a good thing. Immigration, yes, I think, like Mary, I feel very uneasy with some of the figures in the government are saying about immigration at the moment. And I think the government has to have an educative role in showing that immigration normally brings economic benefits to a country, without pretending, however, that there aren't clashes of interest. If you're an unskilled male worker, your interests are really threatened by an influx of immigrants who are directly competitive to you, because many unskilled, especially younger white workers in European countries, do not have job prospects, and those prospects are actively damaged. So the anxieties about immigration are not wholly just fictional. But that's why you must address the real anxieties. Finally, David said, what is the Washington Consensus? Well, I would say it was something that existed at the World Economic Forum before the rise of the anti-globalization movement, when people thought you could run the world like a marketplace, and the anti-globalization movement, whatever you think of it, disabused them of that notion. So it is a consensus no more. even though our masters who rule the world now at least give, I think, more than lip service to the fact you cannot have self-sustaining world with the massive economic divisions that exist in it today. So I think there is a Washington consensus no more, and I think now the anti-globalization movement, which is essentially driven by the rise of the NGOs through the world, at least the more responsible elements of it, now are entering into a much more positive dialogue with those in corporations and in government. I think this could essentially, hopefully, be a positive thing.
Oh, well, I think that's a lovely upbeat note on which to end. We've had some wonderful questions, and I know that many more people would have liked to ask more questions, but all I can say is come to some future events at LSE. And
come to the LSE, yes.
Come to the LSE, and we'll continue discussing these things every day.